is when it comes to the people, they just kind of wing it. You know, what's funny is, like, ask anybody with a business, say, hey, what's your number one asset? And, you know, most of them really believe it, but all of them say it. It's, what's your number one asset? Our people. Oh, really? So how do you manage them? Oh, we wing it.
That was a nice, crisp clap.
That was a nut, dude. Something's been going on lately. I don't know if it's because you've been bringing us such great guests, or because Emma's here. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is.
I think it's because after a year and a half, you've got like a million claps under your belt.
There's a lot of claps.
Practice makes perfect.
Well, there's many applause that have happened. So, hi, everybody. Welcome to Shop Talk Podcast, brought to you by 124Go. I'm your co-host, Chris Salume, and as usual, sort of, sitting here with my great friend, Mr.
John Palmieri.
And we're rubbing shoulders today. Why is that?
Because Emma's here, and so there's three of us screen at this table.
There's three at a table. Yeah. So we're gifted and also blessed today with the unusual stop in from Emma Page, but we're going to be doing some shooting some hair content later. So Emma, say hello to everybody.
Hey everybody, super happy to be here today.
Thanks for sitting with us. And we have an extraordinary guest sitting across the Zoom screen in front of us. His name is Bruce Tolgan. And Bruce is somebody that you just introduced us to recently, and I started to voraciously consume his content that I could find on YouTube and listen to some of his talks, and I think we're in for a real treat today. So Bruce is the founder, co-founder, president, CEO, janitor, all of the above of a small but high-powered crew called Rainmaker Thinking. They're a research, training, and consulting firm. They've been doing this for about 27 years. And I got to listen to a piece of your story. And so what I know is this was sort of birthed out of, you know, the desire to not just live in the bubble. And you started to research and talk to employees and employers and people. Maybe it sounded even more hobby-like and then turned into this thing that's now 27 years, thousands of interviews, thousands of professionals, multiple books that you've written, one that continues to pop up is called It's Okay to Be the Boss. You just shared, you published that in 2007, and now you've got a new one. You just showed it to us on screen. We're excited to talk about it today and your thoughts around it. It's called The Art of Being Indispensable at Work, if I said that properly.
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you so much for including me in the podcast. It's an honor and a privilege.
Yeah, no, welcome, Bruce. We're super juiced up to get started. And, you know, I know with your experience, typically we've been staying inside of the hair industry for a few years, and John and I have recently been having discussions around, you know, people are people and leadership is leadership. And leadership is one of the things that our boss, Brian, you know, believes deeply that is missing in some industries, and ours being one of them, that, you know, most of the people that run businesses inside of the salon world are independent owner operators. They got good at doing the thing. And then because of that thing, they opened a space up and didn't realize that leadership was something different. Right.
Yeah.
And so because of that, we said, let's reach out and talk to other, you know, thought leaders inside of this world. And so we're graced with your presence. And I know there's a million different ways we can take this conversation, John. So why don't you take us out?
Well, I'm going to start off with how we even got here. And where how we got here is, you know, I reached out to Bruce and he was gracious enough to agree to podcast today. And I don't want to spend too much time on it because there's something new and exciting on the horizon. But I want to spend a hot minute on It's Okay to Be the Boss, which is a book that you had written, as Chris had said, a while back. What I loved about that book is in our company, in our industry, growing leaders is a big deal, right? We're always looking for what that next generation of leadership is going to look like. And for many people, I think in our industry, you go from being a comrade to now being in charge, right? You go from being one of the group of employees to now all of a sudden taking on a leadership role. And that struggle, I think, for many people is hard. And I like referring that book because I think it helps people out in that role with, you know, it's okay to be the boss, which I love. You just told me a minute ago before we went live that it's still a really popular book. It still sells quite a bit. Talk about that for a minute, because, you know, after, you know, we'll say 2007, So 23 years, that book is still...
13
years. Yeah, 13 years, that book is still popular. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, look, people move into positions of supervisory responsibility because they're very good at something. Mm-hmm. You know, usually they're good at their job. They demonstrate that they are responsible, that they're into what they're doing. You know, maybe they've been there for a little while and they don't seem like they're going anywhere anytime soon. And so, you know, what happens is they take on more and more responsibility. The more responsibility you take on, pretty soon you got people. You know, but people move into these roles because they're good at some things, but not necessarily because they're good at managing people. And what most people do mm-hmm. is when it comes to the people, they just kind of wing it. You know, what's funny is, like, ask anybody with a business, say, hey, what's your number one asset? And, you know, most of them really believe it, but all of them say it. It's, what's your number one asset? Our people. Oh, really? So how do you manage them? Oh, we wing it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, think of it. And that's true. You know, imagine if you had accountants who you were like, hey, how do you handle the money? Oh, I keep it all up here. See, it's I just wing it. You know, how about with the haircuts? Well, here's what we do. We try never to wash the stuff. And then what we do is we put somebody in a chair where it's hard to get at their head. Mm-hmm. Then we put on a blindfold and we just go crazy with the shears. You know, you'd say, well, that's ridiculous. Yeah. And there's a way of going about that. And, you know, good news, we're really good at it. We'd be happy to show you how, right? But when it comes to managing people, it's like, how do you do it? Oh, we just make it up as we go along.
Yeah. You know, yeah, it's so true.
So the book, you know, sort of tuned into what goes wrong as a result of that and tried to provide some guidance and direction for really anybody who all of a sudden is taking responsibility for the career and livelihood and ability to add value of someone else, you know, which is what a boss really is.
Yeah. So 13 years in, you've got some more, another book, and the new book is called The Art of Being Indispensable at Work. Where did that thought come from? What was a need that you were trying to fill by writing that book?
Well, you know, along the way, we have been studying the dynamics in the workplace. And I did write a book called It's Okay to Manage Your Boss at some point in there. There's the 27 challenges managers face. And, you know, looking at the dynamics in the workplace between and among people and what goes right, what goes wrong. More and more people would say, well, you know, it's hard for me is I'm under more and more pressure to do more and more work. You know, I'm trying to work faster, I'm trying to work smarter. You know, they're cutting our budget, but they're raising their expectations. You know, I'm working with more and more people, I'm handling more and more stuff. You know, and meanwhile, people are always making requests of me from up, down, sideways, diagonal. I have to rely on people all over the organization. There's all these factors outside my control. And, you know, that's what people have been saying. Everybody's under more and more pressure. Everybody's dealing with more and more people. There's more and more uncertainty. And it feels like every day you're trying to juggle and work harder and, you know, just, right. You know, avoid being overcommitted and drowning in everybody else's priorities. And that is what led me down the path of this book. And of course now, you know, everybody's worried because we're going into a depression, you know, possibly an economic depression of some scope, you know, in the midst of the pandemic. Of course, people are worried about all kinds of issues of social justice and, you know, it's possible our democracy is in jeopardy and so on. So we're all living through a lot of really scary stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, people are saying, well, you know, I got to feed my family. So all of a sudden being indispensable at work is serious business.
I think one of the things, you know, I noticed with, you know, people trying to move up within our company, right, is that they've got a role, whatever that role is in our company now, and that the conception is, well, if I just do even more than that, I'll be recognized, people will choose me to be a leader. And the challenge is, of course, is we only can do so much. And more doesn't necessarily, I think we would agree, equate to better, right? And so I'm interested to hear more about that as we go through this process. Chris, I think you got a thought going
on. Yeah, I'm just kind of, I love the idea, and, Emma's sitting here because she's growing within, the brand, the company, not because she does more, even though she will, but because when she does do the things that she does, they're, exceptional, and she, puts her heart into it regardless. One of the things, and this isn't, this might be a slight sort of a right turn or a veer off of, but, one of the things that I've seen happen when people do take that next step, they realize the thing I was doing before was either more fun, it was easier, I was better at those skills, and so now I'm frustrated. Is leadership or management, first of all, are they both the same thing? And second of all, is that for everybody?
I mean, it's certainly not for everybody. By the way, some people really are power hungry and they really want to be leaders. It just turns out they're really bad at it. Mm-hmm. Or that if you give them power, they abuse it or what have you. So it's definitely not for everybody. And, my view is it's a profound responsibility if you have, and I use the term leader, manager, supervisor, because as soon as you are in a supervisory role in relation to someone else, you have power in relation to that person's livelihood and career, to their ability to earn money, feed their family, create conditions in which they work, and be able to make contributions to the mission of the organization. To me, that's profound amount of power in relation to someone else's life, mm-hmm. and in relation to someone else. And I think it should be owned and handled very, very carefully. And so, I think if you were in that role, you are between the individuals and the organization. Mm-hmm. The organization wants to get more and more work out of every person, and of course wants to treat people well, but wants to minimize the costs. And individuals want, what every employer wants is more work, better work, and a bigger smile on everybody's face at a lower cost, right? what every employee wants is the chance to do good work and contribute, presumably, but to have as much control over their work conditions as possible, who they work with, what they do, when they work, where they work, and make as much money and have as much reward as possible. So those interests are in tension. Mm-hmm. And it's a manager's job to balance those interests. Now, my view is, some people are maybe have more natural charisma or ability to empathize or ability to communicate, what have you. What's required of most managers is to navigate that balancing act on a day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month basis. And no matter how high up you go in an organization, that's still your job, really, is navigating that balance.
Mm-hmm. What's the
So it's tough,
What's the sweet spot of balance there? Because, there's the desire, I believe, of somebody who's like trying to work up to have an influence on the company culture, the company outcomes, the things they focus on. So how does somebody find that balance and still kind of maintain ambition that doesn't leave the company, doesn't go rogue?
Yeah, I mean, look, so there's what most people are looking for in their working life and career is a chance to do work that is meaningful to a mission, the chance to earn money and the chance to earn other non-financial but sort of quasi-financial rewards. And then what most people care about is control over their own schedule, control over where they work. Most people care a lot about relationships, who they work with, what they're learning, what the work feels like, is the nature of the tasks, responsibilities. So work is a value proposition, and to your point, leadership is not for everybody, even the ones who think it is. But it's also the case that with responsibility comes people, with people comes leadership, a lot of people, it may not be their favorite part of the job, but they have that authority, so they have to learn how to use it properly.
You know, let's dig a little bit deeper into that. You know, one of the things that I think that comes when you take on a leadership role is learning how to, you know, manage, influence those, you know, collaborative relationships, right? So if I'm working with Chris and I'm working with Emma and you put me in this leadership role, you know, I've got to manage this relationship. And I use the word manage loosely, right? I don't want to tell Chris what to do. I don't want to tell Emma what to do. Yet at the same time, I want us to be able to work together, work toward that common mission. So, you know, and I think the other challenge is sometimes people maybe aren't in that role of leadership yet, but still have to work in a collaborative environment. And they kind of pull back and they say, well, it's not really my job, right? Mm-hmm. You know, how do folks who are trying to build those collaborative relationships, you know, work in that environment that they don't necessarily feel like, it, maybe because they're a little bit shy, right? Or don't feel as though they have the strength, or don't feel as though they have the influence. You know, how do they build on that? Or where do they start?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on whether you have the authority, right? So if you have authority, that means you have power in the organization to give out rewards, possibly impose detriments. You know, then you have authority. Then you have to use that with great responsibility. But influence is more intangible. Mm-hmm. Influence is what other people think of you. Influence is like Emma, you know, look at the how she has said very few words in this, but at least has the look of somebody who's paying very, very close attention. I'm dying to know what's on her mind.
Sure.
That's a form of influence. That's a form of influence, right? Sure. Her influence lives in our minds, right? Because yeah. Whatever influence she has with us is like, I'm thinking, you know, I don't want to say the wrong thing because I don't want Emma to disapprove of me. So I already, you know, I don't want to disappoint Emma. Why? I don't even know her. I don't know.
I'm the opposite of the three of you. I think I'm a person of very few, very concise words usually. So I'm listening very intently. Don't worry.
But you know, but Emma, do you have direct reports in the organization? Do people report to you?
Not directly, no. I'm not in an official position of authority over anyone. I don't have like anyone underneath me. The closest to that I would say I have is on our education team. I help to train the new hires.
And so to the extent that people follow you, I'm guessing they inadvertently take their cues from you. Yeah. Like they're thinking too. Wonder what Emma thinks. Why are you doing that? Well, that's what Emma does, right? Mm-hmm. So it's when people want to emulate you, they want to work with you, they want you to want to work with them, they want to make good use of your time, they want to imitate you. So in answer to that question, you know, that's what I start to look for. Like I don't want to see the person who is sort of like, nobody's around, I'll take charge, right? I'd rather look at the person, nobody's around, oh, I'll teach my colleague, right. I'll help my colleague. My colleagues come to me, right? So I'm looking at the person who, that's why the essence of the new book is the go-to person. Because mm-hmm. I want to know, who does everyone want to go to?
Yep. Right?
And then that's a good indication of, you know, that person helps other people get their needs met. And that's what I'm looking for in a person in the workplace.
So let's talk about that a little bit, because I think that's one of the concepts in your book, you know, the go-to-ism, as I think you call it, right? So I want to be that person that has influence. I want to be that person that is the go-to person or people look toward, right? And I think on the other side of that equation is people overcommitting themselves, right? And so if I'm a new leader, if I'm someone who's just trying to create influence within the organization, maybe for no other reason than just to create some value for themselves, right? How do we balance that proposition of, I want to be a person of influence, I want to be that resource that people can go to, and yet at the same time, how do I not put myself into a position where I'm overcommitting myself? Because I think we both agree that one of the challenges of leadership is when you overcommit yourself, and you get nothing done, right? That go-to-ism starts to disappear.
Well, and that happens at all levels.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the things about go-to people is everyone goes to them. And if they keep going to you, then you're, you know, it's like, okay, I got it. All right, enough. All right, I'm drowning. Right. Yeah. And so that's one of the problems. You know, that was actually the kind of riddle that animated my search for an answer that ended up in that book. Because what I always found so interesting is, you know, well, everyone wants to go to these people, but somehow they're handling it quite well. and the way they do that is, you know, the reason everyone wants to go to them is because they're calm, cool, collected, they pace themselves, they listen carefully, they make decisions. They're what I love this term, slow to know. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, they ask questions. They know, I know the answer to that. And I was like, tell me, right? Tell me more about that. They're slow to know, you know, that they, let me ask more questions about that. And, you know, what's so interesting is that it turns out that, you know, if you try to be an indispensable go-to person by trying to do everything for everyone, pretty quickly you end up doing
very well
for anyone, right? You end up being like a wannabe, an imposter, right. Sometimes go-to person. Should we go to that person? I don't know. Sometimes they're reliable, sometimes they're not, you know? Right. That person used to be a go-to person, right? But the ones who stand the test of time are the ones who are calm, cool, collected, take in information. They know what's what. They know where the boss is coming from. They know where the organization's coming from. They know what's not up to them. They know what is up to them. They know, and they make good decisions. They plan their work. They don't get in over their heads without being clear about, hey, this is a big thing. They get stuff done, and somehow on the other side, their working relationships, it's not other people pointing fingers and blaming,
right?
And then cliques forming and ringleaders emerging, but rather it's, that person's great. Oh yeah, I like that person too. Well, I don't like you. No, but we both like that person.
Right, yeah.
So I hear you describing a pretty well-balanced go-to person, but I think what I see happening a lot of times and what I've been a little guilty of is not being great at saying no. And earlier you mentioned, you know, a lot of people feeling under a lot of pressure and being overcommitted and overextended. Do you have any advice to people on how and when to manage saying no specifically, like turning things down when that's a good idea?
Yeah, in fact, one of the working titles of this book was When to Say No, How to Say Yes. So you're exactly onto something, because, you know, so everyone says, well, you got to learn how to say no, but I don't think so, because, you know, just right. Try it, sugarcoat it, you sugarcoat it all you want. It's still no. Nobody wants to hear no. Mm-hmm. Right. And so no in the moment is tough to say, and it stings, and you just can't sugarcoat it enough. The way for your no in the moment to carry weight is for you to have the kind of reputation where when you say no, I stop and think, gee, maybe it's not a good idea. Mm-hmm. Or when you say no, I think, gee, I must be asking the wrong person. Or when you say no, I think, well, she must have higher priorities, right? Or so that your reputation for making good decisions, there's no shortcut to that, right? So in the moment though, if you say yes and then you overpromise,
right?
If you say yes and it turns out you were the wrong person for that, if you say yes and it turns out you were really thinking no, but you said yes because or what you're really thinking is, you know, you probably shouldn't do that, but you said yes anyway, or like you pretend not to hear. Mm-hmm. Right. And so they can take it as yes or no, whatever. You didn't get the email. What email? Yeah. Oh, yeah, well, all the email goes through. No, I never get your email. Right. Yeah.
Or text messages.
Are you sure that's a technical problem? Because that sounds like BS to me. Right. So in the moment, the key to saying no is being right about it. Mm-hmm. And so here's because in the moment it's going to sting a little. So here's what that whole chapter is about. You got to back up the story a little bit and tune in to the other person's ask. So much of what people say to each other at work is about asking. Mm-hmm. And so often the ask is sloppy, or the ask is hidden, right? Or you might have to say no, or you might want to say no, right? So, but the way you can really make people feel honored and truly honor and respect their need is tune into the ask. Hey, tell me more about that. I'm not sure I understand what you're asking. What is your goal there? What is it you need? Tell me more about that. Why? Tell me what do you need from me exactly? Ooh, whoa, that sounds like a bigger thing than it first sounded. Or, oh, that doesn't sound like a big thing. Or, oh, you know who you want to talk to is Mr. Blue. Mm-hmm. Right? So tune into the ask. Get them to fine tune the ask,
yeah.
Right? Sometimes they might be like, I don't know, I got to go back and fine tune the ask. Oh, okay, that buys you some time, mm-hmm. Right? And then it's going to help them go improve their ask. And remember, yes is where all the action is. That's why you're so tempted to say yes, because mm-hmm. Yes is your chance to add value. Yes is your chance to build the relationship. Yes is your chance. But you can't say yes to everything, so don't waste your yeses. A good no is just saving up time for a better yes.
Love that.
Well, that's a awesome. Great book.
We're going to steal that one from you later. Yeah.
Please.
Yeah.
You get credit for it 3 times on our podcast, and then from there we own it. We don't have any memory of who we got.
You know, listen, it's... It's in the book, so I'm comfortable with that. And you know, back in the old days, I was a lawyer, so my legal advice. Not only that, I'm an officer of the court.
Bruce, it doesn't matter. We don't have a legal system in the United.
No, listen,
States.
I'm an officer of the court in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, right where you are. So
right.
My advice to you. I'm not allowed to give legal advice outside of Massachusetts. I can give you legal advice. My advice to you is it's fine.
So for those of you who weren't here for the beginning of this contest, Bruce and I have a connection to Worcester, Massachusetts, which makes me like him even more.
Yeah. So he knows where Worcestershire is.
Not only does he know how to say it, right? Okay. Yeah, but he knows where it is. Here's what I want to go to. Here's what I want to touch base on and what you just said. I think the value for people saying yes is it's now, like you said, it's immediate, right? The other thing is building a reputation around being that person that can say no and it's okay. That takes time, right? And I think a lot of us don't want to wait, right? Well, if I say no, they might not come back to me right away. Even though that it's probably the right thing for me to do. So I'm going to say yes, because I want that reputation now of being that person that somebody can go to and get stuff done.
Yeah, you're so right. But think of what happens if you say yes, yes, yes. Pretty soon you end up saying no because you're drowning in other priorities. So
right. You might even feel taken advantage of, which a lot of people that'll happen at work, where it's like, well, that's not really a part of my role. They're right. Stacking things on me that maybe they should be taking care of. And you'll find that you'll see that inner conflict happening.
Yeah. And maybe you're just drowning. You have to say no. Or some people, they say yes all the time. And their boss is like, where is this thing? Oh, I'm doing this for that person and that for this person. And they're like, you know what? You need to start saying no to this person and that person. So one way or the other, what happens is if you give bad yeses and no's, you end up having less power over yes and no over time. So to your point, it takes time to build up the influence to have people trust your no's. Mm-hmm. The way to get people to trust your no's is, in retrospect, they were good ones, but they also have to trust your yeses, because you have to deliver on your yeses. If you have a bad record of yeses and no's, you lose power over time. So it's not just neutral. You either gain power with your good yeses and no's, or you lose power with bad yeses and no's.
You know, I won't bore my two podcast mates with me repeating the same stories over and over again. But once upon a time in my life, I'm not going to repeat it. But I realized that saying yes to things, right, and then not getting them done was probably the biggest hit my leadership could take, right? Because I was that yes person and said, oh, yeah, I'll get that done. Oh, I'll get that done. And then 6 months, a year later, right, it didn't get done. And somebody else had to point it out to me. but it was like, remember when you didn't do this? Remember when you didn't do that? And I was like, oh yeah. And that so destroys your leadership and so destroys your influence.
I kind of love what you were saying about, you know, how yes feels, it feels better to say. There's less dirtiness around it. And I could see how, you know, you could get seduced into saying yes to something that sounds easy, mm-hmm. but you know, when you stack it on top of so many things, that suddenly it just becomes, I didn't get a chance to get to it. I didn't get it. And you said overwhelmed, but there's a seductiveness to that. There's almost a dopamine rush.
Sure.
Saying yes, like, wow, this person needs me.
Yeah.
They came to me. I feel important. And how do you weigh out the important, you know, the priority list, right? Of actually, this is really an important yes. And then I love sending them back so they can rethink what their ask really is. What do they really need from you?
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that I'm hearing in this from a little bit of a different perspective is we work in an industry of natural people pleasers.
Yeah.
Who, yeah. I mean, we see it all the time in the salon world. People say yes to things that we knew we should have said no to on the client side. And so thinking about that as well, like what I just heard is saying no makes for happier people in the long run sometimes. Mm-hmm. So saying no can be a positive, a very positive, because if it means they get a better yes in the future, it's worth it.
Yeah, it's like saying yes to cotton candy. Do you have kids? Like you give your kid cotton candy at 11 o'clock at night. Like, you know, boy, the upside of that is very short-lived.
Yeah. Yeah. You know. A no would have been so much better. Yeah.
Right.
And I want to touch base on that piece about, you know, getting things done, finishing what you said you were going to do. Obviously, I kind of alluded to previous stories, but talk about that a little bit, Bruce. There is definitely a power and an influence to being able to start, finish what you said you were going to do, finish things that you were started. You know, we always, I'm a big believer and there's no such thing as multitasking, although my wife will disagree with me all day long.
She's wrong.
She is, but that, you know what, I want to stay married. So
I get that. We have a chain of command in my family.
Yeah, yeah.
Dude, but you're a great multitasker.
I don't think I'm a multitasker.
You know, multitasking in the data shows it's really juggling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because what is possible, so is you can focus on seven things in a second. But you're just shifting rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, it's less efficient, it's less productive, you do less quality work, there's less focus. You're much better off focusing than, because if you juggle, what happens is eventually you drop a ball. Usually you don't choose which ball to drop. And then what happens when you drop a ball is your balance is thrown off and then you try to catch the other balls and they all fall.
Yeah, yeah. It ends up being a nightmare. I just like for me personally, I just like the accomplishment of, okay, that's done. I can move on to the next thing. And my feeling is I can get five things done if I do them one at a time and get them done, as opposed to juggling 10 at a time. And then
yeah, we call that the rule of GSD, which is get stuff done.
Yeah.
Although when it was taught to me, it stood for a slightly different
get.
I don't curse in public, but I do know the words.
Chris is from Philadelphia. First time swearing is just another adjective. You know, so. So one of the things you had a question?
You go, and then I'll go.
I want to talk a little bit about how that, you know, for those leaders who have been leading for a while, maybe find themselves stuck, maybe find themselves where people aren't, you know, recognizing their influence anymore, right? There's a reason you got here, right? There's a reason that kind of waned, that there's a reason why you've lost your influence. Let's talk, I mean, I think we kind of alluded to that throughout this conversation, but I want to talk about it a little bit more, because if we're going back to the title of the book, The Art of Being Indispensable at Work, not everybody's starting off fresh. Some people are trying to, I'm going to use the word reinvent themselves or start over or re-engage people, especially with, you know, some of us working remotely. So, you know, what are some strategies for getting that back again or reigniting that with folks?
Good question.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it depends on what the gap analysis is. Look, everybody gets up every day and does their best, and everybody has bad hours, bad days, bad weeks, bad months. You know, if you fall off the wagon, what do? You get back on. So if you were never on the wagon, then, you know, you need somebody to be like, hey, guess what? There's this wagon. And, you know,
and it's red and it's really cool. And
right. It just depends on where you find somebody. But, you know, most of life, I think, is about getting up every day, taking a walk and eating your vegetables. And, you know, everyone knows what to do. They just don't do it. And, you know, with some people, they sleep through their alarm and they're like, well, I guess I'm not the kind of person who gets up and takes a walk. Well, right. No, you can try again tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know? and you know, I think that, look, that's what it comes down to is try again tomorrow.
Bruce, it almost sounds like, and I'm going to use a dirty word, there almost sounds like you're advocating for a little bit of discipline.
Yeah. I mean, look, the first person you got to manage every day is yourself. And, yeah. You know, everybody has blind spots. There are all kinds of great ways to help yourself be more self-aware. Mm-hmm. I find you mentioned that you have a spouse. I find, you know, my wife and I have been together for 35 years, and she's definitely my biggest supporter and my best friend, but she's also my most trusted critic and coach. And, you know, not everybody has a boss they trust, or a coach they trust, or a mentor they trust, or a significant other. I've found that children can be great sources of self-awareness. You know, if you're in the workplace, you know, you got to ask people to be honest with you. But if they're honest with you, you know, how you respond will have a big impact on whether they're honest with you again. So I think ongoing structured dialogue is the key to self-awareness in relation to other people. Mm-hmm. But, you know, look, self-awareness has become this, like, I'm looking in the mirror and I like what I see. Right. Or I look in the mirror and I don't like what I see. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the mirror is a great teacher, but only if you use it to adjust yourself in relation to objective standards.
Right.
I actually, you just said something. I was going a different direction, but I want to come back to something you just said, because I was listening to one of your talks and I heard you kind of sharing a portion on structured dialogue. By the way, it's something that John practices on a daily, and I mean, he does it masterfully. So if he learned it from you, great. If not, and he, you know,
I'll say it.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Well, it's structured dialogue is the essence of the management approach that we teach. Yeah.
Now,
but I mean, again, it's like, you know, that's like taking credit for get up every day and take a walk and eat your vegetables. It's
totally.
You know, it's just the basics.
Now, we work closely enough that he knows what I'm about to tell you about me, which is I hate structured dialogues. I'm very ornery in meetings. I sit there, right?
Well, I think what's funny, and I want to add this because I think it's all important, right. And because podcasts are supposed to also be fun. When I first started working with Chris, he would say things to me like, don't you throw that crap at me. I know what you're doing.
I know the sales tricks. Right? I know the mind tricks.
That's what you call it, sales tricks. Yeah. And I looked at him and I was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. This is just how I talk.
You know, and then he continued to ask the questions that you're supposed to ask. And it was, you know, it was...
it was funny because for like 3 months, I really didn't know what he was talking about.
And you know, and it's hilarious. The reason why I buck that so much is because so many people aren't as good at John as at implementing those. They can become redundant.
Yeah.
So I'm asking from a leadership perspective, how do you set up those structured dialogues in a way where they don't feel, you know, they can start to get boring, condescending.
So Chris doesn't think you're just using sales lingo on.
Well, so I can do that with somebody else. Cause I definitely, I mean, if you're a well-trained salesperson, I can watch your next line coming out of your mouth, especially if you use the materials from the 80s. Right. So there are certain, you know, there are certain one-liners.
What are you saying?
Well, there are times where John, you know, at the end, you know, he'll say to me, is that okay? Right? And I'll always like give you the look like, you know, don't give me that. But, you know, we're good friends. So we, you know, we can kid around like that. But in all reality, how does a manager leader, you know, not become redundant when the system they're trying to manage does have a level of repetitiveness, redundancy? How do you keep people inspired inside of those structured conversations?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, the reality is that conversations can easily become pro forma. Mm-hmm. You know, check the box. How's everything going? Just fine. Everything on track? Yes. Any problems I should know
exactly.
about? Well, you know, and those conversations are not meaningful. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't take a walk every day and eat your vegetables. So if a coach is running alongside you saying, you know, push off, tuck your chin, run faster. And you're like, you're just trying to make me run faster. Well, yep, that's what I'm trying to do. No hard feelings. That's my job. And, you know, so, you know, hey, dot this I, cross this T. I get it. Well, hey, I got an idea. Cross your T's and dot your I's, and I won't keep telling you. So, you know, some stuff is not up to you. No hard feelings. I'm paying you. So, you know, part of it is that, and just know, you know, that's the structure of the relationship. You do your job, I'll do my job. Part of it is working with people in such a way that you say, look, you demonstrate mastery and you get a lot more autonomy. Mm-hmm. You demonstrate self-mastery. And why would I try to manage you? Then what I want to do is learn from you. I want to innovate with you. I want to collaborate with you. And so some people, the role of a leader is, you know, they try to light the fire in your belly. My opinion is that very few people are qualified to light the fire in anyone else's belly, and it's none of your business, really. Now, some people, they need a fire lit under your chair. You know, if that doesn't seem like you, but some people, like if you don't light a fire under their chair, they're like, you know, what are you doing? Oh, just, you know, waiting to leave. You know, well, you know, why don't you sweep the floor? Bah, you know, I swept the floor yesterday. Right. We'd like you to sweep the floor every day. You know, hey, how about that conversation with that customer? What do you mean? Well, how do you think it went? Just fine. Well, how about where you were cursing at the customer? Well, they got to learn sometime. Nope. We don't want you to curse at our customers. You know, so, but in some cases, you know, look, everybody's different. And to me, if you go to somebody and say, are you ready for our one-on-one? And they're like, well, I don't have anything to talk to you about. And oh, okay. Well then tomorrow. That's like going to the gym, swiping your membership card and going out for donuts, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, like, sorry, swiping your card isn't what it's about. So you say, well, what do? Go in there and walk on the treadmill. Well, that's not enough exercise. Okay, good, run. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what about weights? Well, then lift weights. So, you know, what I think is that employees, too often they're like being managed at. I'm managing at you. And whereas, you know, as you evolve, what you're trying to do is have good conversations about the work that makes the work go better. And right. That's really what the conversation should be at any level. Let's have good conversations about the work that helps make the work go better.
Right. I think, you know, one of the things, you know, we utilize one-on-ones within our company. Our managers, you know, have one-on-ones with their stylists. And I think oftentimes our managers struggle, and I'll talk to them about it and say, you know, where's the challenge? Well, they don't have anything to say. You know, they don't have anything they want to talk about. And my usual refrain is, well, you know, what are you bringing to the table? You know, what are you talking about? Because if you're not interesting, if you can't bring some value to the conversation, I can see how, you know what, I don't want to have this monthly conversation or biweekly conversation because nothing comes from it. Now, granted, as you said, some people need to have, you know, a fire under the chair, right? That's a little bit of a different conversation. But I think if you're coaching, creating influence, you've got to bring some value to that conversation and be known for that if you want people to be engaged. Right?
Yeah, and I mean, look, there's a couple of very simple tactical techniques that I would use if I were in your shoes working with leaders maybe further down the chain of command. The two of you seem to have your relationship all worked out. Emma's still a wild card. But you know, what you want to do is have people keep a running list of things they want to talk about.
Yeah.
And people interrupt each other all day long. People touch base all day long. Well, keep a running list. One thing we do with creatives is have them keep a running list of ideas, because at the end of the month, they might want to pitch one of their ideas. Mm-hmm. So troubleshooting, problem solving, resource planning, issues with people, ideas they have, ways to do more work, ways to do better work, ways to avoid unnecessary problems, ways to improve the environment in the workplace, business ideas. So, you know, in general, you want to start with what are you doing? How are you doing it? What do you need? Here's what I need from you. But maybe it's drilling down on expectations. Maybe it's, you know, the hardest thing to manage of all is attitude. Sometimes that's the thing that's most important. Troubleshooting, problem solving, resource planning. But the most important thing you can do is get the people to prepare for those one-on-ones with their boss. Mm-hmm. What you say to them is, hey, we're going to have our one-on-one on Thursday. By Wednesday night, just give me a one-pager of, what's on your mind.
Yeah.
That's a very simple coaching question. What's on your mind?
Yeah.
It's at least an opener. But you know, what a lot of managers do is they have a template.
Yeah.
It depends on what you're trying to do. If you're trying to drive up sales, then, you know, talk about up sales. You know, oh, we talked about this last time. Yes. And you're still not upselling. So we're going to role play. Playing? I hate role playing. Well, then upsell.
Everybody hates role playing. Everybody.
Yeah, everybody hates role playing. Well, which would you rather do, upsell or role play? Because if you don't upsell, we're going to role play.
Yeah, and now I'll say I'd rather upsell. Right. And nobody likes to role play.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think we're going to save that one.
Yeah.
So let's fast forward a little bit. We've gone through this process. We've learned to be a person of influence by learning when to say yes, learning when to say no, right?
When to say no and how to say yes too. When you say yes, make a plan. Yeah. Let's execute.
Yeah, wow. Love that. And so you're starting to find your way into a leadership position. I think one of the challenges that many people have when they start making that transition is they're now surrounded by different people, right? They're surrounded by people they may not know very well yet, because they're a different place in that chain of command, but now they're there. I think some people worry too much about office politics and what that looks like. But more importantly, I think, you know, maybe there comes a little bit of intimidation. I don't know this person. They've been doing this job for a while. Do they look at me as being competent? You know, let's talk about that a little bit. How important is rapport building there? How do I go through that process? How do I?
Well, there's a term I was looking at in our notes called an upward spiral of influence, mm-hmm. like creating, how do I kind of create that influence? And I think that's perfect. Sort of the question that you're heading towards.
Yeah, I mean, so the way to develop the upward spiral of influence is to just add value in every interaction. Mm-hmm. When you're having a conversation with somebody, whether it's about your ask or their ask, mm-hmm. whether it's about no or yes, whether it's about making a plan or executing, or whether it's about looking afterwards and saying, hey, what could we have done better here? Just try to add value in every interaction. When you do that, what happens is the interaction goes better, so it's better for everyone. Usually it helps the other person do better and add more value in the interaction and in the work. And it gives you that that reputation. It's not, you know, a lot of my advice sounds like Dudley Do Right, but the reality is that's what makes stuff go better. Mm-hmm. And so if you add value in every interaction, things go better for you, they go better for the other person, they go better for the enterprise, and they go better for your reputation.
Right.
And how you conduct yourself, how you treat people is a huge part of taking charge. So the upward spiral is there whether you have power or not. Mm-hmm. You know, the upward spiral is just who you are and how you show up and how you conduct yourself. When you move into a position of supervisory responsibility, you know, I think the biggest problem people have is, you know, do I downplay that? hey, I'm still one of the gang.
Right.
We're still friends.
We're still buds. Yeah.
Yeah. Or do they say, you know, hey, there's a new sheriff in town, right? It's about time I took over. And here's how it's going to be around here, see? And that's no good either. And what a lot of people think is, well, gee, they put me in charge. Maybe they think I shouldn't be in charge. Somebody else should have been in charge. So at least be clear about why you're in charge and why you're as good a person as any to be in charge. Be clear about that. Be prepared to answer that question. And then you think, well, but boy, these people are new. You know, they've been doing this for a long time. So you think, well, I have a lot to learn. I know what I'll do. I'll learn and then I'll take charge. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think that sets a lot of new leaders up for failure. We have a very simple rule, which is, of course, you have to learn. So take charge by learning. Mm-hmm. And whether you're in charge or not, you should be learning. And you should be building that upward spiral by learning. And as you build that upward spiral, keep learning. And as you take more and more authority and as you know more and more, keep learning. And when should you stop learning? Right. Well, when you want to start dying or when you want to start seeming stupid or whatever. But a lot of people, they don't want to learn in plain sight, right? That they want to, oh, I already knew that. Oh, yeah. I already knew that. Or if they're learning, they learn secretly. Because what people who do that don't know is that smart people are always learning. And so when they see somebody not learning, they're like, gee, do you not know about learning? Because this thing we're always doing. When smart people see somebody learning, they're like, oh, hey, you're one of me. You're one of us. You're a learner. If you're smart, you're a learner. If you're a learner, you're probably smart, right? So so you got to learn. It's okay to learn and take charge at the same time.
Dude, this has just been such a killer conversation. I mean, like, I feel like we could keep going for hours. I know we all have hard stop times, and the people that are listening to us may be close to arriving to work, but I want to say thank you, first of all, to Bruce. And Bruce, how we typically wind up our podcast is I'm going to go to Emma and John. They're going to share what they're walking away with, and then I'm going to give you the floor to A, let us know how to contact you, and then B, any closing thoughts you have. So, but thank you so much. Emma, a lot here. I was watching your eyes light up on his last rant. What are you pulling? What are you pulling with me?
His last rant.
I did very much enjoy the last rant, but I think the biggest thing that I'm walking away with is that no really just means you have value-added yeses later. So no for better yes.
Yeah, that was awesome.
I liked everything in this conversation, which is, you know, why I do podcasts, because we get to have great conversations with lots of people. But if I'm thinking about things, you know, it kind of reminds me of, you know, I love the yes and the no piece. And I think we all kind of know that in our back of our brains somewhere. But I think the way that you highlighted it and brought it to life was really important. You know, one of the things that I like about, you know, making sure you ask more questions, right? Because sometimes that yes that you want to say yes to is harder than you thought. Maybe it's a lot simpler than you thought. So that makes the yes easy. But I think there's also value in asking all that questions, because the person that you're asking the questions of might be able to solve the issue all by themselves. I always like to remember that questions aren't for you. The questions are actually for the other person, because, you know, and the leader of our company, Brian, does this all the time. I'll ask for something and he always follows up with, well, what's the reason behind this? Tell me more. And then 3/4 of the way through the conversation, I'm like, okay, we're good here. I'm done. You know, meaning I got
it. I got it.
You know, and that's the gift he brings, right? Is that telling me what I wanted to hear, but helping me figure it out on my own. And so I think that's really important. Thanks for sharing it.
Yeah, that's awesome. Bruce Tolgan, thank you so much for taking your time, just with the awareness that you've got everywhere from young people to older people at all stages of their career that listen to us. Any words of inspo you want to leave us with?
Well, I'll tell you something. I learned something the other day from a longtime client, somebody I admire a great deal. His name is Greg Langell. He just retired as Deputy Commander of Joint Special Operations Command for the United States Armed Forces. A really neat guy. And he said something to me the other day, which I just loved. And that was, practice being the person you want to be.
Mm-hmm. Love that.
That's awesome. Bruce, how do we find you? How do we find out more about you? How do we get your book?
Rainmakerthinking.com is the best way to find me. And but I'm also at Bruce Tulgan on Twitter, I'm told. And my email address is brucet@rainmakerthinking.com. And you know, you can get the book at Amazon and wherever books are sold, because you know it's Harvard Business Review Press is the publisher, so I feel like all grown up now.
Yeah, that's awesome. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Every time we have one of these conversations, I walk away with a little bit more than I knew before I came in, and I love that about these podcasts.
Yeah, it's amazing. We also walk away with a lot of gratitude to our listeners. You know, we're watching those listens go up. We hate to ask, but we know there's a few things we need to ask for.
I don't hate asking. Not even a little bit. Hey, for those of you who haven't heard me ask before, 5-star reviews. You got the phone in your hand. It's down by your lap. I don't care where it is, but it's not that far away from you. 5-star reviews. You know you want to do it. You know you love this podcast. Share it with the world, because every time you create a 5-star review, an angel gets his wings. Did you know that?
Yeah. And while that angel is getting his wings, it helps us move up. You know, it helps us get more noticed in the podcast world, helps share the message. And if you're really being served by this, which we hope you are, you know, we'd love for you to share that with some other salon owners. The other thing we're going to ask you to do is to follow us on Instagram at 124.go, as well as Facebook. We're going to get more active on our Facebook page. And so if you're a Facebooker, then follow us on Facebook at 124.go. And if you're a Grammar, please tag us in your stories, and we'll do the same in ours. So thanks again for listening, everybody. We will see you on the next episode. Bye.